The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and probably from the Harvard Women's Health Letter as well. The first article comes from the Harvard Heart Letter of September 2024, and it's entitled, Upcoming Surgery? You may not need any heart tests beforehand. Even in people with heart disease, pre-surgical cardiac testing should be the exception, not the rule. And it mentions at the start, if you're slated for surgery, bring the following to your preoperative evaluation: a list of all the medications you take, including over-the-counter drugs, vitamins, and other dietary supplements, any imaging or testing results done at other facilities, and contact information for your primary care provider and your cardiologist if you have one. If you've ever had surgery, you may recall having a preoperative evaluation, sometimes called a clearance for surgery. These checkups take place prior to a planned non-cardiac surgery and typically include a physical exam and a detailed medical history. You may also get blood tests and x-rays, and you might have an electrocardiogram, a quick painless test that records your heart's electrical activity. But what's the real purpose of a pre-surgical ECG, and when does getting this test actually make sense? For the vast majority of people, even those with known heart disease, an ECG isn't helpful before most surgeries, says Dr. Christian Ruff, Director of General Cardiology at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital and Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. The purpose of a preoperative evaluation is to assess whether a person might be at elevated risk of a heart-related complication during or after surgery. However, an ECG, which lasts only about 30 seconds, isn't necessarily the best way to gauge a person's risk, and sometimes the findings end up delaying a person's surgery for no good reason if they trigger unnecessary additional testing. About half of the millions of surgeries done in the United States every year are minor procedures, like those to treat cataracts or repair damaged tendons or joints, often referred to as same-day outpatient or ambulatory surgery. They do not require a hospital stay. Other examples include a breast biopsy or hernia repair. These low-risk procedures put very little strain on the cardiovascular system, and the risk of complications is minimal. Still, an estimated 1 in 10 cataract surgery patients receive preoperative ECGs, despite the fact that the American College of Cardiology discourages ECGs in people slated for low-risk surgery, provided they don't have any symptoms. Of course, major surgeries pose a somewhat greater risk to the heart. Surgeries that open the skull, spine, chest, or abdomen may lead to blood loss and fluid shifts in the body, which can put extra stress on the heart. So does anesthesia, which can cause changes in heart rate and blood pressure. Still, ECGs aren't routinely needed even before major surgery, says Dr. Ruff. Instead, asking about how people feel when they're active is more important. If a person can walk up one or two flights of stairs without any significant symptoms like chest discomfort or breathlessness, they're at very low risk of cardiac complications during surgery. However, ECGs do make sense for older, inactive people with heart disease prior to major surgery. We want to make sure they're not having any signs of reduced blood flow to the heart or an unstable electrical heart rhythm that may require treatment before they undergo surgery, says Dr. Ruff. People who have recently experienced a heart attack or pulmonary embolism, or who have received an artery-opening stent, will likely need to delay any elective, that is, non-emergency surgery, for a few months. Elective surgery itself isn't always a choice, but to some extent you can elect when to have it. In addition, many people with heart conditions like atrial fibrillation or deep vein thrombosis take medications to prevent blood clots. Because these drugs can cause increased blood risk, they should be stopped 2 to 3 days before surgery. Why are routine preoperative ECGs a problem? If the results are abnormal, the doctor then may order more tests, like an exercise stress test, which monitors your heart while you exercise on a treadmill. But again, the findings are somewhat inconclusive, leading to yet another test. This cascade of testing often ends up doing more harm than good because of the added cost, time, and stress it causes patients, not to mention potentially postponing a surgical procedure that can improve a person's quality of life. If your healthcare provider says you need an ECG or another test, ask, "What are you looking for? And will the results change how you will treat me with respect to the procedure?" says Dr. Ruff. Now we're going to turn to Harvard Women's Health Watch for September 2024. And let's start with questions for Dr. Tony Golan, who's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard's Women's Health Watch. And the first question is, why does everything taste salty to me? The answer is, this phenomenon certainly puts a damper on enjoying your food, but you should know that there are many possible reasons food can taste oversalted. Do you have seasonal allergies? Sometimes postnasal drip can lead to a salty sensation, as can an allergy to particular food. Also on the list of potential culprits are gastroesophageal reflux disease, diabetes, certain autoimmune conditions, and vitamin B12 deficiency. Even a chronically dry mouth, which can be a side effect of various medications, can make food taste especially salty. Even if you have one of these conditions, don't just accept living with a salty mouth. It's wise to mention the issue to your primary care doctor. She'll work with you to help improve your symptoms, which may be as easy as changing your medications. Otherwise, she may recommend some simple blood tests to investigate the cause. Now here's another question for Dr. Tony Golan. My pap test results came back as abnormal. Does this mean I have cervical cancer, or is there another possible explanation? And Dr. Golan responds, the explicit purpose of a pap test is to screen for cervical cancer and precancerous conditions. Cervical cancer is diagnosed in about 13,800 American women every year. But there are definitely other possible reasons that cells collected from your cervix may appear irregular. While nearly 4% of all pap tests are flagged as abnormal, most of those findings don't indicate cancer. Indeed, most are benign and may result from a cervical or vaginal infection. Frequently, pap tests show changes related to the presence of human papillomavirus, or HPV, which can cause genital warts and precancerous changes that need further testing. While HPV is a virus, it is not a typical infection. Most women are exposed to it at some point during their lifetime and become carriers of the virus after they are exposed. HPV does not often cause symptoms, and it can come and go. So just because your pap shows you carry the virus today does not mean the test will show the virus a year or two later. Typically, your gynecologist will follow up an abnormal pap test by performing a brief procedure called colposcopy. She'll look at the cervix, vagina, and vulva in more detail using an instrument called a colposcope. which can magnify areas that appear abnormal and may take a biopsy. Depending on what she learns, you may need additional follow-up testing or treatment. Now here's another article from the Harvard Women's Health Watch, and it's entitled Physical Therapy, Myths Versus Reality. Don't let misconceptions about physical therapy derail you from achieving a fuller recovery. If you think of physical therapy as a regimen of targeted exercises done in the aftermath of surgery or injury, you'd be partly right. But if you've never done PT, or it's been years since you did, it's time to view it with a wider lens, a Harvard expert says. Physical therapists work with far more types of patients than in just those two realms, including people coping with stroke, brain injuries, balance problems, neuromuscular conditions, spinal cord injuries, and more. More than 50 million Americans seek physical therapy every year, taking part in an estimated 300 million total therapeutic sessions to improve their mobility, strength and flexibility, and maximize their physical functioning. People tend to think about PT with a very narrow scope, says Mary Kate Miller, clinical supervisor of physical therapy at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehabilitation Outpatient Center. They think we give massages or only work with people in pain or after surgery. Manual therapy is a very small part of what we do, she added. Physical therapists are really movement specialists. We help people optimize movement. From the start, physical therapy deviates from conventional healthcare approaches by offering patients a large measure of control. We spend the first day learning about each patient and what's important to them, and working together on a plan to get them back to what they want to do, says Miller, who is president of the Massachusetts chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association. It's really a collaborative effort. Miller offers these additional examples of how PT may differ from what you might expect. The first myth is that only people with pain need PT. While the most common reason to seek PT is back pain, accounting for one-third of cases, physical therapists treat patients with a broad range of other conditions, including pelvic floor dysfunction, vertigo, neurologic disorders, and a high risk of falling. Yes, people in pain are probably our bread and butter, but we improve mobility, enhance function, and optimize health across the board, Miller says. We see a lot of people just trying to live their lives, and whether they play sports recreationally or just want to lift their kids or carry their laundry up the stairs. Myth number two is physical therapy isn't working unless it causes pain. The adage, no pain, no gain, doesn't apply to physical therapy. I cringe when I hear someone call physical therapy pain and torture, Miller says. While some things we do may create some discomfort initially, our goal is to get patients to a point where they're not in pain and to promote healing without causing unnecessary pain. The third myth is any healthcare provider can offer PT. Highly specialized training, which may culminate in earning a doctorate, is required. Many providers may offer similar interventions, but you're not going to get the same comprehensive level of care as you would with a physical therapist, she says. The next myth is, physical therapists will tell me to stop doing my favorite activities. The fact is that we will not do that, Miller says. My favorite part of being a physical therapist is helping people find ways to do what they love. We work with people to set goals that are meaningful for them, and work to get them back to those activities. I can count on one hand the number of patients I've told no, you can't do that, or that's not achievable. The next myth is, I need a referral to see a physical therapist. Not usually, though some insurance plans like Medicare do require a referral before covering the treatment. But many private insurers don't require that. You can just walk into a physical therapy center and get scheduled for a visit. It's always a good idea to check with your insurance company first to make sure. If you're already undergoing physical therapy or planning on doing so soon, Miller offers this advice to maximize its benefits. Be open. Be honest with your physical therapist about what's most important to you, so you can work together to establish goals that are meaningful. You should also be an active participant. Physical therapy is not something where the physical therapist is going to tell you what to do. They're teaching you tools for how you can help yourself, she says. If you take ownership over your health, you'll definitely get the most out of your experience. Now we're going to read an article from the Harvard Women's Health Watch. It's called Menopause Supplements, Effective Relief for Empty Promises. Natural remedies abound for menopause symptoms, but it's wise to be wary. What do a major drugstore brand and America's sweetheart Drew Barrymore have in common? Both are hawking dietary supplements claiming to help American women who crave relief from the often disruptive symptoms of menopause, and both carry credibility that can sway midlife women hovering over pharmacy shelves to believe that natural remedies can ease hot flashes, maintain libido, clear brain fog, or smooth mood shifts, among other benefits. Dozens of over-the-counter supplements are now being advertised to menopausal women as a part of a $17 billion global market that's expected to grow more than 5% a year until at least 2030. The phenomenon has been dubbed meno-washing, for its propensity to convince consumers that menopause relief is as simple as popping a pill. But the growing market for natural therapy skirts over the fact that supplements don't require FDA approval, Harvard experts say. Many supplements also haven't undergone rigorous testing. That means there's no evidence they actually work, or even that they're safe. These products are touted by movie stars, but every woman who swallows them needs to know who's making money from this, says Dr. Jan Schifrin, director of the Midlife Women's Health Center at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. Women with bothersome symptoms are being preyed upon by profiteering marketers. Dr. Peter Cohen, an internist with Harvard-affiliated Cambridge Health Alliance, agrees. It's predatory, says Dr. Cohen, whose research focuses extensively on dietary supplements. Many menopause symptoms can profoundly affect your life, but by promoting a quick fix, supplement companies are misleading women about how these symptoms can best be managed in a healthy and safe way. Much data reinforces the notion that marketers are targeting a massive cluster of midlife women with impressive buying power. Nearly 63 million women were 50 or older in 2021, roughly 19% of the U.S. population. They boast a combined spending power of $15 trillion and control 95% of purchasing decisions in their households, according to AARP. About 6,000 women in the United States reach menopause every day, totaling 2 million each year. But this transition, which marks 12 consecutive months without a menstrual period, typically begins years before and can linger for years after. Marketers have all realized there is a large number of well-educated women out there with money to spend, Dr. Schifrin says. Many women between 45 and 65 have spare income and are experiencing very bothersome menopause symptoms. But women are doing their part to fuel the demand for menopause support products, Dr. Shiffrin says. Women now have high expectations for healthy aging. They're saying, wait a minute, I'm going to spend a third of my years beyond midlife? They want these years to be truly terrific. The key question is if ingredients in menopause supplements can indeed help women achieve their goals for a smoother transition. Like the major drugstore branded version, many such products combine a variety of herbal or botanical ingredients like Dong Kai, milk thistle, and black cohosh. The supplement backed by Barrymore purportedly supports hormonal harmony with a blend of chromium, a trace element naturally found in foods, and compounds like Korean thistle, thyme, saffron, L-theanine, and maca root powder. Some products are single-ingredient herbal supplements traditionally tapped for hot flash relief, including the aforementioned black cohosh, as well as red clover and evening primrose. But none of these ingredients, and indeed no dietary supplements or herbal remedies, are considered effective for menopause relief by the Menopause Society, which released a positive statement in 2023 on non-hormonal therapies. And because supplements aren't regulated by the FDA, there are no guardrails ensuring how much of each ingredient you're consuming, or whether the supplement even contains the stated ingredients. If these supplements really had the purported effects, if tomorrow you took this pill and your libido actually increased or your hot flashes resolved, that would be a very potent compound, Dr. Cohen says, and that sort of potent chemical should not be taken in the form of a supplement which lacks any FDA scrutiny. It's sort of catch-22. If they're working, I'd worry about what's in the supplement. And if they're not working, then women are just being misled to spend money on something that's ineffective. Skepticism is warranted. If hot flashes and night sweats are your curse, as they are for an estimated 80% of women in the menopause transition, taking a menopause supplement is just as likely to bring relief as using a sugar pill. That's because no one has identified a dietary supplement for hot flashes that's more effective than placebo, Dr. Shiffrin says. On the other hand, the placebo response is really powerful. Placebos reduce hot flashes by 30%, even when measured objectively with temperature sensors on the skin. There are real effects. They're just not due to what you're swallowing. It's smart to be skeptical. If it sounds too good to be true, then it usually is, Dr. Shiffrin says. Wouldn't we all love a little pill we could take once a day to treat our sleep problems, irritability, disordered mood, low libido, hot flashes, and night sweats? If you could actually put it in a pill and prove it was effective, we would already have it available in a tested formulation together with a highly profitable pharmaceutical company. Dr. Cohen advises women to steer clear of any supplement marketed for menopausal symptoms. But if you decide to consider any, Harvard experts offer this advice. Check the label. Make sure it says USP or NSF, which indicates the supplement has been tested by a third-party organization that confirms it meets science-based quality standards. Avoid blended products. If you want to try black cohosh, for example, choose a supplement containing only that herb, not as part of a menopause support mix. That's the only way to truly know you're getting black cohosh. But even those companies aren't ensuring the concentrations are appropriate or safe. Watch the side effects. If you experience any unusual or alarming symptoms after taking a supplement, stop taking it immediately and talk to your doctor. Even if the symptom is short-lived, that doesn't mean it's not harmful, Dr. Cohen says. It's much harder to eat healthfully, exercise regularly, and control weight than to pop the supplement, Dr. Schifrin acknowledges. But these lifestyle measures are far likelier to improve your sense of well-being during menopause. A half-hour walk with a friend 3 times a week will do much more for your midlife symptoms and health than swallowing any supplement, she says. Then there's a brief article that summarizes the results of an April 2024 study on menopause. The study found that women whose periods had ceased by age 46 were 1.5 times more likely to perceive their job skills poorly compared to other women, which appeared to make them more likely to retire early on a disability pension. But many factors may account for women's decision to leave the workforce earlier than 65, says Dr. Jan Schifrin. Early menopause, which occurs in an estimated 5 to 10% of women, isn't always a natural process. It may happen due to treatment for cancer or another condition, also influencing a woman's decision making about her professional life. Women who reach menopause before 50, and especially before 45, should discuss hormone therapy with their healthcare practitioner, Dr. Schifrin advises. For women who can safely take estrogen, there is strong evidence supporting it having important health benefits when menopause happens early, she says. Well, it looks like we don't have time for another article at this time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Yunkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.